Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker Football Podcast. My name is Jake Entwistle, back this week after an incredible job by temporary host Sam Long, who finds himself in the corner of the room this week recording the sound. We're training him to do every part of the podcast, so soon it'll just be a one-man show. But joining me as guests this week, returning from last week's podcast and not being forced to record the sound, is Chief Editor at Squawker, Will Hall.
Oh, I threw myself.
And you've now...
You're a little rusty this week, aren't you?
I am rusty. 2 weeks of doing it on a Thursday, isn't it? So it's been a long break because we had the Monday episode that was quick fire. So I don't know what I'm doing anymore, mate.
Oh, you're all right. It's not too bad. It's good to have you back.
It's not too bad, Jake.
It's not too bad. I did listen to last week's, or the Squawker 6 section, and noticed you both fumbled again by what tackles are and what they actually mean.
Yes. Well, you know, I didn't have you around to save my life. So I thought I'd try and be a bit jakey, and I was like, maybe I didn't really get it right.
It was interesting, though, because I actually did speak to someone. Someone posted a thread on Twitter about like how tackles are being misused. And I was like, it's not the fact they're being misused.
Yeah.
There's loads of definitions. And tackles, one, is where you tackle someone and keep possession.
Yeah.
And a tackle made is where you tackle, you could win the ball, but then it could pop out to the opposition.
See?
And that would be a tackle lost, but you should be rewarded for the individual action.
See, that's where you were missed, you see, last week.
Well, that's why I've added it this week. I've learned from what was brought up on last week's podcast. And now, Squawker Talker listeners, you have a full repertoire of tackle definitions at your disposal, which will be perfect for our first topic this week. Sort of, which is going to be, of course, Man United versus Liverpool at Old Trafford, because Liverpool have plenty of records in their sight. And before we go in to the actual match and the tactics and what needs to be done, and also whether actually any Man United players would get in to the Liverpool team, I was just going to review some of the records that Liverpool and Jurgen Klopp's team are hunting at Old Trafford. There is, of course, the one everyone knows about by now, which is the most consecutive wins in English top flight history. So it's not just Premier League as well. This is, in the history of the game, Man City have won 18 consecutive games and Liverpool are one away. They're looking to equal that. And I thought to give a bit of context to see how they've done it as well, I've just got some basic stats around it. So Man City after 18 games, which was all within one season as well, which I know is a point of contention that people like to highlight, they scored 58 goals. They conceded 11, they kept 9 clean sheets, they created 248 chances, and they only faced 36 shots on target in that time. They were pretty dominant. Liverpool, after 17 games, 45 goals, which is 13 fewer, 13 conceded, which is 2 more, 6 clean sheets, 3 fewer, 219 chances created, I can't do mental maths quick enough to find out the difference, and 41 shots on target's face, which is 5 more. So, in those stats, Man City slightly more dominant.
it's almost like Man City are really, really great. Liverpool are also really great, just not quite as great. Also, though, they might make up all of those numbers against Man United, let's be honest.
Yeah, well, that was almost going to be the test. It's right, they've got to get 13 goals. Can they do it against Old Trafford? But maybe not that many. And interestingly, when we talk about Jurgen Klopp's record at Old Trafford, they don't actually score that many under him. Anyway, the second record, which I almost prefer, just because it hasn't been as spoken about as much, is that if they win, they'll become the second team to start a Premier League season with 9 wins, following Jose Mourinho's Chelsea side from 2005-06. And again, little stats there. Chelsea had scored 23, conceded just 3 in those 9 games, and kept 6 clean sheets. Liverpool, after 8 games, 20 goals, 6 conceded, and just 2 clean sheets. But Will, we were speaking about this, and Liverpool have only conceded 6 and only kept 2 clean sheets, but they've never conceded multiple goals. And they have a habit of scoring multiple goals every game. So it's almost like a foregone conclusion that they will win by outscoring the old adage, even though the defence is still actually statistically pretty good, conceding the fewest in the division, I think, with 6. The final one that I wanted to bring up, which leads into the analysis you've been tasked with this week, Will, is that Jurgen Klopp has actually never won a game at Old Trafford.
Right.
And in the Opta preview of the match, it's the most amount of games at an away ground without winning in his career. 4 games at Old Trafford, no wins, and it's been Man United 1, Liverpool 1, Man United 1, Liverpool 1, Man United 2, Liverpool 1, Man United 0, Liverpool 0. So what... this all-conquering Liverpool side that haven't been outside the top two for the last 10 years, why can't they beat Man United in probably Man United's worst period in the Premier League?
I think it's just as a fixture. It's the nature of the fixture. For a manager who thrives off self-belief, I don't think there's a ground that Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool, that makes Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool more nervous. Or at least Old Trafford is one big away fixture in which we're yet to see them really take the shackles off. They've gone to Nou Camp and obviously they got torn apart there, but they created quite a few chances and they certainly weren't conservative in their approach on that evening. Man City, they obviously beat also in the Champions League. So that might be a factor, those European nights instilling the belief that they sometimes lack on afternoon fixtures in the Premier League. But in any case, it's not really an extraordinary claim because both teams are historically desperate not to lose this particular fixture. Gary Neville in a Sky Sports promo this week said playing Liverpool was a game he could never look forward to because of what was at stake. And with these current Liverpool and Man United teams, that specifically is reflected in the number of draws they've played out. Overall in the Premier League, Klopp's lost twice to United, beaten them once and drawn four times, which is a little over half. Or for maths graduates out there, 57%.
Calm it down.
And to put that in context, in the last three full Premier League seasons, 22% of all games have ended in draws, so it's double the average. Another thing that speaks to the fact that this game has a particular inclination towards ending in a draw is that since the start of the 2016-17 season, no fixtures resulted in more draws. Four in total, than Liverpool versus Manchester
United. Cheers, Jose.
Home and away. Well, yeah, but some of those games, Klopp is the constant for that. He's the manager who's overseen all of them. For Manchester United, you've had Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, Louis van Gaal, and Jose Mourinho. And to come back to this idea that the desperation not to lose is what I think has caused this, is the fact that 0-0, the most cagey of scorelines, is the most frequent outcome, both home and away, when these two teams play. It accounts for a third of the nine games played between United and Liverpool since Klopp took the job. Or if you narrow the focus to solely Premier League games, it makes up three of seven. And obviously we saw the last visit to Old Trafford end 0-0 in what... I mean, Klopp, after that game, came in for more stick than perhaps after any other result. Maybe they've been heavy defeat, sure, but in this game it was seen as a huge missed opportunity. United made like three substitutions before half time.
I was going to say that was the game.
I think he didn't necessarily blame that, but he did seem to suggest that those changes disrupted the rhythm of his Liverpool side.
I mean, that was the game that ended Solskjaer's run, basically, because his whole thing was predicated on the front three of Lingard, Rashford and Martial, and they all got injured in that game.
Well, I think I actually looked... So this is... I think this game immediately followed the defeat to Paris Saint-Germain.
Yeah.
And United actually did go on and win three games in the league after this. I had it in my mind that this is when United hit their rut after the amazing start Solskjaer made, but they actually did recover, and then they had that terrible spell.
But the thing is that it was always coming, like, because the forwards, Lukaku, I think, delivered the Palace win, and then it was the that night in Paris. So the wins after that were not very, like, you could see the wheels starting to wobble a little bit. And then you're thinking, oh, and then they won in Paris, and everyone was like, oh yeah, give them the job permanently, and they sort of forgot the fact that it was all built on these three forwards, and two of them were injured. One of them was not fit. Rashford hasn't played well since then, I would argue. Not consistently for United anyway. And I think, that game was pretty interesting, really. And I mean, I always thought it was strange that Klopp didn't just go for the kill second half. First half, okay, fine. They're changing constantly. You don't know what they're playing and injuries and everything. But, and I know they lost Firmino themselves, right? He had to go off injured.
Yeah, Daniel Sturridge, I think, came on for him and then
got injured.
And then he recorded Liverpool's only shot on target during the entire game. Yeah,
getting back for the game. And it's interesting as well, the lack of goals and this not going for the killer instinct. Liverpool's fabled front three do not enjoy playing Man United for Liverpool, and as we said, which coincides with being under Jurgen Klopp. Salah has scored against 21 out of 24 of the teams he's faced in the Premier League in a Liverpool shirt. Mm-hmm. Man United, Sheffield United earlier in the season, and Swansea City are the only teams he hasn't scored against. So he's looking to cross Man United off that list. Roberto Firmino has scored against all other big six rivals in the Premier League, yet to score a goal in the Premier League against Man United. And Sadio Mane's only got one in the Liverpool shirt. And has actually missed two of the games through injury.
Yes.
So this is not a sort of happy hunting ground or happy fixture for that front three.
One of the things I would say is that this was the game that, ahead of which City had just overtaken them in the league. And the point that Liverpool earned at Old Trafford actually put them above Man City by 1 point. But there was a psychological factor at play there in that City were, I was going to say literally, but not literally, breathing down the back of their necks.
Breathing.
They were metaphorically up the table.
Up the neck. What's the reverse of it?
So that, and then Klopp alluded to a sense of mental fragility. He said he could see something off in the faces of his players after the game. And you would say that since then, that's one thing Liverpool have improved really well. That sort of,
I was going to say,
Klopp's referred to them as mental giants on so many occasions. So that seems like a change that could come into play in the two teams play each other on Sunday.
Do you think what change, if there was going to be one change that could alter this sort of low scoring draws between these two teams, do you think Jurgen Klopp has it in him to make it, or will he sort of go with the same approach?
I don't think we're really going to see a high scoring game, because Klopp's never really demonstrated the gung-ho attitude we tend to associate him when he goes away to big six rivals. But one thing I would say that Liverpool have that they didn't have last time is, I think Trent Alexander-Arnold didn't play in the last game, which you might not have looked back on that and seen it as a weakness, but for a guy who just got into the Guinness World Record
for not a world record
12 assists, well, exactly, that's a very good point actually,
in an English league.
So that speaks to the fact that maybe they could have done with his creativity, or although it's a counterfactual to go into that too much. But the other thing is that this time they're more than a point ahead of Man City in the league table, and they have maintained that lead over a couple of games now. So there's not the sense that it's not at such an advanced stage in the season that there feels like they can't slip up.
Yeah, don't bottle it. It's in fact the biggest lead at this stage of a season after everyone's played eight games in the Premier League era. So they couldn't be in a better position, really. No one has been in a better position than them.
Yeah, because on the one hand, for Klopp's Liverpool team, Old Trafford is not the ideal ground to go to attempting to set the Premier League record or the English top flight record for consecutive wins. And I have to say that matching Man City in this sense has to have at least crossed the Liverpool players' minds, no matter how much they will all say that the focus is just on the 3 points or whatever.
And also, it's Manchester City's record, and Manchester United are looking to end it.
So,
or if Manchester United don't beat them, or don't even remember, they just have to draw to end the winning streak. That's what's almost forgotten, is Man United don't have to win this to end this
streak.
And a
draw is the most common result in Klopp's time. So on the other, it's just precisely for the same reasons that I've just given, considering the glory at stake, Liverpool being able to do something they've never done before just makes it totally the ideal ground.
Yeah, but Jurgen Klopp has a worse points per game average versus Man United across all competitions than he has against any other English club, 1.22.
Yeah.
So this is the thing, is Man United, as bad as they are, seem to be, and Will's said it multiple times there, it seems to be the one ground where Jurgen Klopp is still a bit within himself when visiting. But surely, a team with seemingly no weakness, or do they have a weakness, against a team with whose only strength is really defending, surely there's no threat of them actually being beaten, despite a draw maybe being the common result.
I mean, this is the thing, though. I think their weakness is Old Trafford, as you guys. Their weakness is Man United, as you guys have already alluded to. If you look at the history, I'm obviously, Mane 1-7 games, Salah 0-4, Firmino 2-10. That front three is Liverpool's strength. They carry them. And none of them have won more than they've lost against Man United. I think Salah has one draw, one loss. Firmino and Mane have both lost more times than they've won against Man United. So, Liverpool they've won, I think, twice at Old Trafford since 2004. One being the 4-1.
The famous 4-1. Yeah,
and then they beat Moyes, which isn't really the same, That's not really beating Man United. And then they put the 4-1. So that's two wins and like in all that time. I think that's 16 times they've played at Old Trafford across all competitions. They've only won two in the last since 2004.
They haven't won there since 2014.
Yeah, it's a long time. And I think the weakness is going to be the fact that it's Old Trafford. And I mean, you mentioned the fact that they've got such a comfortable lead over City. To me, that just speaks more to the fact that the streak's going to end. Because they are, you know, they're comfortably ahead. A draw is not a disaster. Like, if they draw this game... Yeah, whatever, big deal. I mean, you could even argue if they lose it, big deal. But obviously, losing is something they don't want to do.
Losing to this Man United team.
Yeah, no, but this is the thing, isn't it? I think they will. Liverpool, just as last season, when I think Jurgen Klopp was like, okay, we're not going to lose this game to Man United. Let's go out and let's try and we're better than them. We should be able to get a win just by being better than them. Let's just not go out and not lose the game. And I think that in a way backfired because, as Will said, they got a bit nervous. I think maybe, and it was like, oh, United actually, and they didn't really give it enough of a go and attack to actually hurt United, who were there for the taking. Even with the wheels still on, with the full team fit, United were still there for the taking. And once the wheels came off, they were definitely there. So they didn't go for it. Now, yes, since then they've won the European Cup. They've come back from 3-0 down against Barcelona. They've shown a lot more killer instinct, but I still think the fact is they're so far ahead of Man City, they're so far ahead of everyone else, they're very comfortable. I think they'll go there thinking, all right, let's not mess up and give this terrible United side a chance to win, and then let's go and win the game. But I don't think they'll really push on as they normally do. I mean, look, and more to the point, I don't think they'll be able to necessarily have it all their own way. Liverpool, Man United have allowed, well, Liverpool have allowed 77 shots against them this season. United have only allowed 78. It's only one more. They've conceded eight. Liverpool have conceded six. Man United have conceded eight. And remember, Man United have no attack to speak of. Mm. They can't generate any sort of offensive thrust. And they've conceded only two more goals than Liverpool, conceded only one more shot. So they are a very good defensive team. Mm. They can't attack for toffee, don't get me wrong. They're awful in attack. But in terms of stopping the opponent, they're good. And they could be even better if the attack actually starts functioning.
Well, the whole point could be made about the wheels coming off could literally just be the wheels in attack coming off.
Yeah.
And speaking like the fact that Marcus Rashford has been burnt into the ground, seemingly, and then that the supporting cast has then been injured, so he's had to continue that role.
It means that we
highlighted a lot of stats that Man United had the most fast breaks since Ole Gunnar Solskjaer took over. Marcus Rashford was leading fast break goals. If he is not fit and can't run at full speed in that system, then they don't have an attack to speak of, as you said.
They've each had five fast breaks this season and each scored one goal from the fast breaks. So, you know, so it is, like you said, that they're an evenly matched side defensively, and offensively the difference is huge, clearly, but that's partly down to injuries, also partly down to, I mean, let's be honest, even if United had a full strength team, they're still not as good as Liverpool.
Speaking of Marcus Rashford, though, if you remember the last time Manchester United won in this fixture, his two goals, he exposed on the day a defensive weak link in the Liverpool team, that channel between Dejan Lovren and Trent Alexander-Arnold, two really good finishers. Those came at a point where pundits were seriously suggesting Rashford should be sent out on loan. Out of form Marcus Rashford can be a good thing for United.
I mean, yeah,
history repeats itself.
We've seen this, haven't we, with Rashford repeatedly, is that whatever else you want to say about him, when big games, he can produce. He's scored against Man City, scored against Arsenal, scored against Celta Vigo in Europa League semi-finals.
Oh,
you know.
You're at Celta Vigo.
Hey,
I'm kidding. As you said, it was a semi-final.
It was a built-in free kick as well.
And they ended up winning the trophy in that game. Yeah. Again, in the Opta preview, which was another juicy stat, was that a third of his Premier League goals have come against the big six.
Yeah.
So we're talking about Salah, Mane, Firmino having one between them in the Premier League for Liverpool. Rashford's got more against Liverpool than they have combined against Man United.
Yeah,
so they have the man that loves this occasion. And I remember when we spoke about the Sheffield United game and saying where was Liverpool's weakness there, and Sheffield United played really well. I said the heat map, you could see they targeted that channel behind Alexander-Arnold, who, as a Guinness World Record holder, is being given more and more of the ball for Liverpool this season in a wider position, higher up the pitch. So that means there is a bigger channel to exploit.
Yeah.
The one thing is they don't have Paul Pogba sweeping passes to pick Rashford out.
That's going to be a big
miss. And you don't know who in the Man United midfield. It maybe even has to be Harry Maguire that actually directly finds Marcus Rashford.
I mean, that's
there.
The thing, because I think one-on-one, I think Alexander-Arnold has shown that he's a solid defender. He's athletically capable enough, and he's got enough tackling technique and everything that if Rashford tries to run in 1v1, he could probably match Rashford. We've seen him match Sane, so we know he can match Rashford.
But also, I think he has nightmares of it. I think that was a particular game where it was 1v1.
Because if you remember the first goal, he sort of did the... I don't want to say it was the Ronaldo chop, but it was kind of like that. And then
Rashford loves a flick flack as
absolutely
well.
Absolutely sends Trent Alexander-Arnold, and then he just sort of...
Yeah, so it's going to be the interesting... That's going to be the key area, really, because if Matip has a weakness, it's on the floor. He's obviously imperious in the air, Joel Matip. And I think if United are going to resort to hoofing crosses, and they're not going to get any very far at all, because Van Dijk obviously is amazing everywhere, but Matip in particular is great in the air. But on the ground against pace, we saw against Sheffield United, he can be got at. And Alexander-Arnold, as we know, he will leave gaps because he goes forward.
I think that's Liverpool's... I think it's not necessarily players even now. It's Liverpool's setup. If they try to impose themselves as they have done on every other team, that is the biggest hole you can exploit.
Yeah.
And it's whether Man United then, without Pogba, who Solskjaer has said is unlikely.
De Gea and Pogba
are out.
Been ruled out.
De Gea is not that massive a miss given the form he's currently in. If we're being perfectly honest, I think Romero can come in and replace him. Pogba is a huge miss because McTominay is an able worker and he might ping one in from 25 yards on accident, but he's not going
to... Literally, that's just because that was his last goal.
His other goal, he did it last season as well against Wolves.
The Liverpool fixture, though, is not one in which Pogba has acquitted himself amazingly well. I think he gave away the penalty in the 2017 1-1 draw, and I think has been criticised for his performances generally in these games.
Pogba's been criticised for his performances.
It could be a game for Fred. You never know. I mean, he showed him against PSG, the big stage. He likes it, so maybe...
Cleverson has said that his career isn't over yet, which I found there was a bit of irony in Cleverson saying that someone's career wasn't over at
Man United. Fred is a great footballer. We know this. It's just he's not settled in at United. Now, I mean, you know, he showed against Paris that he can play well, so there's always every chance. Liverpool are a great team. Objectively, they are better than Man United, unquestionably, no matter what happens on the weekend, but I think they might go in...
Whoa, are you about to do a prediction?
No.
Because if you've read the agenda,
yes,
you're not allowed to
There's
do
no
this
agenda.
Yet.
This is all off the cuff and just inspired by what we're talking about.
I stopped because I burped, but then also now I'm realising that that's actually not a bad shout.
So cool your heels.
So let's cool your heels exactly there. The one stat I'll just lead in before our final look section is this. Man United have failed to score multiple goals in 7 out of their 8 Premier League games this season.
Yeah.
After the 4-0, which was just blitz on the counter-attack. Liverpool have scored multiple goals in 7 out of their 8 Premier League games.
You're
this season.
Dangerously close to doing a prediction.
No, I'm not. I'm just saying that's like what we're talking about.
You're just putting two facts there.
Hanging the predictions like a fruit in front of the listener. Because before we do the predictions, we wanted to address the fact that a combined 11 has been produced in the build-up to this game, which is the go-to strategy for everyone around the world. And just like it was, I think it was the Spurs-Arsenal game, wasn't it, that famously had no Arsenal players in the combined 11, and then Arsenal won, and then I can't remember which journalist it was.
Yeah, I think it was Adam Crafton.
Then got torn to pieces, which is, again, the evils of social media and the fact that everyone was ready, in hindsight, to criticise it when beforehand you probably could have argued that to some extent. So we're not doing it with the benefit of hindsight. We're saying, I think it was Danny Mills' combined 11.
So it's Danny Mills' one. And I also saw someone, I saw another one that Sky Sports had done with, I think it was Jose Enrique, which was also was just the Liverpool 11.
In case you missed it, at the moment, most people's combined 11s do not include a single Manchester United player. Mm. And on current form, again, you could probably argue because the players that have performed well for Man United are probably being outperformed in their own position by Liverpool's incredible squad. So rather than just thinking completely on form, the last little bit on this before we get into prediction is which Man United player could have a chance of becoming one of Jurgen Klopp's loved ones? Which player in that Man United team would earn the most hugs from Jurgen Klopp?
I think Marcus Rashford. I think if you look at him, he's fast, which Klopp loves. He presses, which Klopp loves. And he defends like a maniac, which Klopp loves. I think Rashford, with the side serving of Jesse Lingard, because Jesse Lingard just is a Jurgen Klopp player, just not playing for a Jurgen Klopp team. You can just see him. He's not particularly... He's a Jurgen Klopp midfielder, through and through. Not particularly genius with the ball, but an absolute machine at pressing, counter-pressing, shutting down opponents, nicking the ball back up the field, and scoring big goals. He could play for Liverpool, any Jurgen Klopp team, with his eyes closed.
He's a stats ghost. Is like Genie Wijnaldum. Because I was trying to... When I went through this,
He gets called ghost on Liverpool Twitter.
Does it?
A criticism for going out.
So this isn't a criticism. This is me objectively saying that sometimes the statistics will not show a player's value. Because I went through and I said, it can't be Harry Maguire, really, because Virgil van Dijk and him both play on the left. And yeah, we know that if Serge Gnabry's about, and if you put one of them on the right, it's dangerous. It can't be any of the front three, I thought, because as good as Marcus Rashford is, and I wrote down that Rashford has this skill set that Jurgen Klopp would love to sort of develop at the moment, if you were just considering the team. He's not getting anywhere near it.
There's only two United players that can get into Liverpool's team. But
And then I said it can't be Wan-Bissaka unless Trent Alexander-Arnold moved into midfield. But then Liverpool side, as I mentioned earlier, are built now to use their fullbacks as the main people on the ball. So it wouldn't be him because they're different types of fullbacks. Alisson is better than De Gea right now in all facets, but especially with the ball at his feet, which ticks Jurgen Klopp's box. And then Wijnaldum, who for Netherlands has scored as many goals in 2019 in 8 games as he has in 34 for Liverpool in this calendar year, was one player that I was thinking maybe he could be replaced. But for Liverpool, Genie Wijnaldum is just Mr. 90%. Out of all the midfielders, including Man United's, including Paul Pogba, who I sort of foregrounded as the main man that could probably get into that Liverpool midfield, Wijnaldum has the highest pass accuracy out of all of them, 90%. But he's really low on chances created per 90 minutes, doesn't get fouled often, doesn't complete that many dribbles prolifically yet. And I've mentioned this before, the Wijnaldum sort of cycle that goes around is that he'll be Liverpool's most underrated player until he has a bad game, and then he'll be not good enough for the Liverpool team and then build up his reputation again of being the underrated player. Yeah. I actually thought Pogba wouldn't replace him because they're a different skill set, which left me to think that Paul Pogba would probably get in ahead of Jordan Henderson because, by my analysis of it, is Henderson is in the team to play more ambitious passes, which may be reduced given the fact that Alexander-Arnold and Fabinho now do that a lot. But Henderson's skill set was more in line with Pogba's. And I thought that Paul Pogba, if he could return to a more dynamic box-to-box role, which Henderson has now been asked to do in a number eight, Pogba would add a bit of dribbling that they wanted from Naby Keita and Oxlade-Chamberlain.
Yeah.
And therefore, I think Pogba, with a bit of love as well, would be a big player under Jurgen Klopp.
Yeah, that's the key thing, is Pogba needs to be loved and appreciated. He would be under Jurgen Klopp. Pogba walks in ahead of Henderson, with all the greatest respect to Liverpool's captain. He's not on the same stratosphere of talent. He works hard, probably harder than Pogba, but it's not the same quality player, and Pogba would easily replace him. Maguire versus Van Dijk, obviously Maguire's not getting ahead of Van Dijk, but centre-back, he showed vaguely against Bulgaria. You could put him on the right.
I was
going to
say, against Bulgaria.
Yeah, well, no, it is Bulgaria. But no, so I think Pogba walks into the team, I think.
But then it's
Maguire, depends on what you're going to do with centre-backs. No one else, I would agree with you. No one else, I don't think, gets even close, really, to Liverpool teams. Exceptional Wan-Bissaka, but Wan-Bissaka's a completely different kind of player.
Yeah, that's...
And we've seen, as Will has mentioned before, just simply putting a better defender there than Alexander doesn't necessarily work because Liverpool's defensive setup.
Alexander-Arnold's value to that team is not his defensive ability.
Exactly. So, I don't think
there can be any argument that Pogba's more talented than Jordan Henderson. But the whole narrative surrounding Pogba, and I guess this depends on how much you agree with it, is that the midfield has never really worked because they've never found the right solution. And the implication being that the midfield should be built around Pogba. And as we've discussed countless times on this podcast, Liverpool's team is built at the expense of the midfield. So I don't know how those two things can really can really exist together.
Well, I mean, I think it's... I would agree. You're right. Obviously, Pogba needs to have the midfield to be a bit around him to play the kind of dominant game that he wants. But at the same time, I think Liverpool's midfield is so not built around the midfield. Liverpool's team, sorry, is so not built around the midfield that in turn it comes back and benefits Pogba just the same, because okay, fine, he's not going to be playing passes and dominating the ball, but it means he can just get forward into the box loads. Crosses are coming in from Alexander-Arnold. Pogba is like 6'2", 6'3". He won't be the kind of Pogba that we've come to expect almost from France, but he's got a completely different kind of skill set, as Man City can tell you from 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when he led that comeback, scored those goals at Old Trafford. Pogba has a goal-scoring technique, a great ability to score goals. Doesn't necessarily do it all the time because United have other weaknesses that he has to fill. I think in Liverpool, what you would see is the kind of thing you have seen from Henderson a lot lately, where he's been running into the box late, either scoring goals or making crosses or cutbacks or something right at the end. So I do think, even though he obviously, it wouldn't be the same kind of Pogba that we expect from Pogba, which is the weird thing. A lot of Pogba's problems are people expect him to be this kind of midfielder or that kind of midfielder, and he is uniquely his own kind of midfielder, I think. So I think he would actually thrive in Liverpool's team. I don't think he would be the... I think Rashford or Lingard would be the kind of player that Klopp would love more. Because they're just
Rashford.
Just relentless runners.
You look at the sort of... The transfer speculations around Liverpool this summer. The most were making the point that their weakest sort of area of the squad is that sort of centre-forward position, where I guess you've got Divock Origi, who's been the ultimate super sub on some huge occasions. But he's also used out wide somewhat. And but with Rian Brewster yet to really come to the fore, Daniel Sturridge obviously let go. There doesn't seem to be...
But Rashford wouldn't play centre-forward under Klopp. That's the point. He'd be Sadio Mane.
Well...
It would be... That was my... Well, that's my opinion. I don't think Jürgen Klopp would love Rashford as the striker. I think he'd want to make him Sadio Mane again.
No, but he'd love
him. I mean, it's difficult to argue against that because it's a hypothetical. I could see him doing it. I mean, he
I think Lingard would be more suited to that role.
Yeah.
I know, and I do agree with the sort of system player take that Mo mentioned, but Rashford used to be a playmaker coming up, and Firmino swaps to go out wide so frequently that
I
can see what you're saying there. And the other element of the Rashford shout is that Liverpool could do with some good free kick takers.
But listen to Rashford is not good at them, apparently. there's plenty of memes flying about. About where his free kicks end up.
That's true, I guess.
So it's just he has the Ronaldo free kick,
but we've
of where the spectacle of him taking it.
The quality of the individual.
I would argue though in Rashford's defence with regards to free kicks is that the amount of pressure that's on him to score those because United can't score goals anywhere else.
How frequently does he take them for?
Often enough. But I would argue. And maybe this is just because I'm being protective of Rashford, but I would argue that maybe in a team that was less reliant on please someone score us a goal, you know, if their team was more confident scoring goals elsewhere, he might score more. Although I do think the comparison to Cristiano Ronaldo is most apt because I don't think he's ever going to be really like he's not going to be Juninho Panambacano, is he? He's not going to be high frequency, like 50% conversion rate. But
he has the confidence to take them.
Yeah, right? And I love
his technique is... I've made a video on it once.
It causes trouble. It causes trouble for opponents. I mean, if he can get it on target, at least... I mean, it doesn't even have to go in. If he can get it on target, it'll cause enough problems in terms of goalkeepers holding the ball.
I guess if I can backtrack a little bit as well.
Section.
It was mainly like the sort of versatile forward option who can fill in either of those positions.
But I would expect him to thrive most in playing as Sadio Mane, who's been transformed into a goal-scoring wide forward, and who also, we were talking about Rashford's sort of ability to defend well for the team. Sadio Mane's defensive numbers have rocketed up this season. Yeah. So Rashford would almost fit that statistical profile in itself. But in terms of getting into the actual team right now, I thought Pogba would have the best chance and be the most loved by Klopp.
I think if you had Pogba, you couldn't not play him as well.
Yeah. I just think as well, and I agree with your point about the midfield being bypassed, but you could see Pogba return to that almost pseudo left wing role he played at Juventus and work in tandem with Mane and just become a goal scorer.
Forget Mane, Firmino and Pogba will just be devastating to watch, because if you look at what Firmino excels at is those little flicks, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, yeah. Pogba coming forward, playing it into Firmino, and he'll just get the ball returned to him every time.
Or would they just get in each other's way?
This is a discussion for another day. We could talk... endlessly about which Man United players could get into the Liverpool team, how they would function, the tactics behind it, but we do not have the whole day to do so.
That's a trick.
Oh yeah, just ruined the end there. But we're going to take a little break now before returning to, as I said, we've still not given you the predictions yet. Those are coming up later. We'll take a little break now and then revisit the events from Bulgaria on Monday evening. On Monday night at the Stadion Wasilewski, England's black players were subjected to monkey chants and racist behaviour, which triggered the UEFA protocol. The European football governing body has since charged the Bulgarian Football Union with 4 offences: racist behaviour, including chants and Nazi salutes, the throwing of objects, disruption of the national anthem, and replays on a giant screen. 2 charges have also been brought against the English FA, including disruption of the national anthem and insufficient number of travelling stewards. In the aftermath of the game, many reporters have come out to say that it was the worst racism at a football match that they had experienced personally, which has led to an increase in frequency of the conversation about whether racism in football has reached its peak at the moment, and whether we are now sort of hitting the worst of racism again in modern football. We just wanted to address it, of course, because we recently, Mo had an interview with Marvin Sordell, former footballer, about racism in football and about how it affects the players as well. But we also wanted to shine a light on whether racism has got worse and the reasons potentially for it, and what could be done to, again, decrease the amount of racism and these number of these incidents in football that we are seeing.
So I've seen quite a few suggest that the problems experienced in the 80s, periods like that, were somewhat worse. but the number of matches at which hate crimes were reported increased by 47% in England and Wales during the 2018-19 season, according to Home Office statistics, that is, which show this number rose from 131 to 193. And of those matches, 79% of the incidents were related to race. That is quite a spike, and is in fact the seventh consecutive year where reported incidents of discrimination within football have increased. Although the Home Office report, which was released last month, does say some of the increase is caused by improvements in recording. Said improvements are typically related to technological advancements like apps, such as the one launched initially by Kickout, I think in 2013, and social media, where Kick It Out say they often get reports submitted to them via. Social media, of course, has also become a site of the racist abuse, though. Just this season, we saw Tammy Abraham, Paul Pogba, Marcus Rashford, and Yaku Mate, I think I'm saying that right, a Reading striker, abused on Twitter within a single week. I don't have figures for so these figures, I should say, are sort of based from football matches taking place in England and Wales. I don't have figures for games elsewhere in Europe. Obviously, the events took place in Bulgaria. Much has been made of the rise of far-right populism within certain European countries. So,
yeah, and I think it's important as well to highlight the rise in England itself, because a lot of the debate became sort of Bulgaria are in the
Gareth Southgate has said as a couple of years ago that English, well, maybe a year ago, that English football needs to get its own house in order, to quote him directly, with regards to discrimination. He also was careful to make that point in the build-up to the Bulgaria game. And he, in fact, did say it before the Bulgaria coach came out with his initial comments before the game, where he said, Bulgaria doesn't have a problem and England is worse for racism, effectively. Those comments look quite foolish now. His comments after the game were also very embarrassing. I think he's rowed back a little bit.
And also, as well, in the Raheem Sterling himself quote retweeted those comments from it and said, not looking too good. And Borislav Mihailov actually resigned as head of the...
Yeah, he was urged to do so, or told to do so, by the Bulgarian Prime Minister.
Yeah, so they've... There's been, within Bulgaria, despite, again, people that were in the press conference reported that some of the Bulgarian journalists were sort of laughing and joking about it, and there were comments said to Gareth Southgate in his, and the Bulgarian manager denied hearing or didn't want to say it was or wasn't racist. But there's also been people from within Bulgaria, or with ties to Bulgaria at least, that have reacted negatively to it. And I mean, video that
Hristo Sojkov obviously was pictured on Spanish TV talking about it, and he was very passionate about it. He unequivocally was like, look, you just got to ban them. You got to just, you know, it has to be, take them out of football. He referenced Hazel, the English fan, well, in the English club ban that they had after Hazel, where they weren't allowed to play European football for 5 years. Liverpool, I think, got six. And I think he said, you know, the Bulgarian teams, club level, country level, just ban them for 4 or 5 years, just no football, because then they'll learn. I think he was going into the, I think, people that he was mentioned alcoholism or something, but he didn't finish his point. He got very
he had to pause.
Yeah, he broke down. So I think his point is that people, that a lot of these people are misbehaving. His point is the best way to get rid of them is to ban Bulgaria. Now, I mean, I spoke to Marmoset obviously about this, and we were speaking before the game happened. We recorded our interview, so and we released it afterwards, but we recorded before, and we were talking about like the protests, and Tammy Abraham also, of course, had come out and said, look, we're ready to walk off if it happens. And Marmoset supported the idea of walking off, the players walking off. And we also, the one thing he said was, we were talking about what's the possible punishments, and we both said, you know, well, it should be fine, shouldn't it? It should be points deductions. And some people were saying, you know, that's quite harsh. I put it to him, you know, is that harsh? And he said, and I quote, he said, it needs to be that harsh. If that's already happening, if what's already happening isn't working, then it's not harsh enough, clearly, because people are still doing it. It's still being racist. It's back to me now. You know, so, and he's right, because people are still being racist. They're still racially abusing people. So whatever the punishments that exist are, I mean, there's the famous example of Nicholas Bentner got more for showing his wrong gambling sponsor on his pants than most nations do for racial abuse. You know, then yeah, it's the idea that points deductions shouldn't be considered this sort of, oh, it's too harsh. No, it needs to be very harsh. It needs to be, you know, you can't just keep slapping people on the wrist for this. Because obviously, look, racism, and again, this is discussed in the interview, racism is a societal problem. It's not a football problem. It's existed before football. But football has a responsibility to deal with it within its own remit, right? So you can't just be like, well, so I mean, you know, as some pundits have kind of said, well, it's a societal problem, nothing football can do, it's pointless getting angry or whatever. You know, we have to get angry, we have to get active, we have to combat racism directly. UEFA's protocols, and you know, this is just my personal opinion, I don't think they're very effective in the way that they're enacted. They didn't even enact the second point two properly. You meant to take the players inside the locker room, and they were just standing by the side of the pitch. Point one, as we saw, only inflamed the situation further. You know, the Tannoy announcement came out, and all you heard was more boos and more monkey chants. Like, it just made them angry. Like, they were being told to stop. Like, you know, like they're school children or something. And point three, the only one that has any effect, wasn't enacted at all. And after the match, Greg Clark, FA chairman, said that he had spoken to the match officials and UEFA officials, and the reason it wasn't suspended was because the incidents after halftime were isolated incidents of racism, i.e. from individual people, I'm guessing, versus the mass demonstration of racism, which was the group of people who I believe were ejected or left.
Yeah, they left the stadium
just before halftime, because they were there doing Nazi salutes, raising banners and things, and that was very sort of, if not organized, and they were clear, a lot of them all doing
the same
thing.
They were wearing like branded t-shirts, yeah, saying no respect
to UEFA, and so they were all there to do that, and so the idea was that was mass problem, so the protocol deals with that. But then the protocol is ineffective if the protocol doesn't deal with a single incident of racial abuse. Like, for example, when Raheem Sterling was racially abused at Stamford Bridge last season, it wouldn't count as mass because it was one person, it was like, yeah, four people. So
Chelsea later banned
they took action, but
that was sort of a club,
yeah,
less directive.
And Chelsea have a good history of banning racial people who are racist. They did it with the people from the Paris Metro. They did it with the people who racially, anyone who's been found guilty of racially abuse. Chelsea are very good at the guys that chanted at Mohamed Salah. They banned them as well. So Chelsea are good at when racism rears its ugly head, they at least suspend the guilty parties. But I just think ultimately what we'll come back to is that whatever the punishments are, it keeps happening. Chelsea is a good example, actually, because Chelsea have been banning these guys, but it keeps coming back, keeps happening, because the punishment isn't severe enough to make clubs and countries and FAs really take a serious stance and put serious money and serious efforts behind actually helping to eradicate racism in the football sphere, make it so that it's repellent and repugnant, and no one even wants to do it. You know, Kick It Out said after the game, their long statement, but right then they said, there can be no more pitiful fines or short stadium bans. If you ever care at all about tackling discrimination, and if the Equal Game campaign means anything, then points deductions and tawny expulsions must follow. That was Kick It Out. They basically echoed what Stoichkov was saying, although, I mean, they weren't referring to him, but that was their conclusion as well. You need, if you want to combat this scourge, which is racism, and I mean, look, football has a history of this. In England obviously, with hooliganism, when hooliganism, to link back to what Stoichkov said, when the Hazel disaster was caused by hooliganism, obviously, and it led to the big stadium, the big European ban for English clubs, the Football Spectators Act of 1989 and the Football Disorder Act of 2000 both made big gains in curbing hooliganism and helping eradicate it, obviously. And so, but race, so there is scope and there is precedent for FA intervening and making actual laws that make it much more difficult. And I think it wouldn't be remiss or it wouldn't be out of place or too harsh to say that if they were to step in and make an act, the government would step in and make an act, someone to make an act or to make a law that says, you know, if you are found, if there is racial abuse in your stadium, then you lose points. You are banned, you know, you are banned from, kicked out of tournaments if it's a cup game, or you're simply deducted points, you know, and you lose, because that's ultimately affecting the result is what's going to make people start to realize that, oh, we can't do this. It's not just a laugh. It's not just, as Inter Ultras said, we're not just trying to upset our opponent. It's racial abuse, it's bigotry, and it can't be allowed to stand. And, you know, affecting the result is the best way to do that, I think. Ultimately, racism is a societal problem, but football has a responsibility to deal with it.
And the final part of this week's podcast will be to finally deliver those predictions that we promised you in the Liverpool-Manchester United chat at the beginning. But before we do it for that game in particular, we thought we'd just address the big TV games this weekend as the Premier League returns. And starting with Everton versus West Ham, the early kickoff on a Saturday, which, as I said, is on television for your viewing. Will, I'm going to come to you for this one. Is there any particular prediction or theme that has swayed you when analysing this fixture?
I basically delegated it to two of our writers, one of whom supports West Ham, Ben Green, of Tom's clan.
Yes.
And so, of course, also a West Ham fan. He predicted 3-1 to Everton. I then spoke to Chris Smith, our Everton supporting writer, who I gave a shout out to last week, on last week's recording. And he predicted the exact reverse. He thinks West Ham will park the bus effectively and win 3-1. So I didn't know what to do. I had to do some research.
Yeah.
And look into this one. But so it's not looking good for Marco Silva, of course. Perhaps this weekend only Spurs are under more pressure to win than Everton, and I mean, that's up for debate, really.
Based on fixture.
I mean, Everton are in the relegation zone.
The first time since 2017 I found out that happened.
Which isn't too long ago.
Two years, but he was meant to have changed it.
Spends money like they do. West Ham obviously beaten in their last game. Everton in even worse form, 4 straight defeats, I think it is. But despite Chris's idea that they might turn up and play very compact, which Everton have struggled against, basically, is the point he was making. Mm. When I looked into it, it seems like West Ham haven't been too shy of opening up and attacking when playing away games. They've actually clocked as many shots on target away from home as Liverpool in the Premier League this season. And if that's the case, if they're going to turn up and play, I think that could let Everton off the hook somewhat, because you can imagine that if the game pans out in a way where Everton are being frustrated, being kept out, then that's not good for a team sort of very much under pressure to win, pick up those 3 points, as I've said. So I think that could let Everton off the hook and allow them to sneak a narrow win. I've gone for 1-0. So we'll probably see Sidibe come in for Svended Coleman. My prediction is that he'll set up the Everton goal, cross scored by Calvert-Lewin, who has the joint second most headed goals in the Premier League since the beginning
of
the season.
You absolutely love predicting someone scoring a headed goal, and that is the only thing.
It's true.
Well, it's because
you
just
do
money.
I love specific predictions.
How funny is it that then I said something more specific that you actually love doing?
Yeah.
Mention Mane scoring headed goals.
Yeah, because I love that Merseyside stat about him. I think he's level second with
the Merseyside marvels in the air.
Mm. Chris Wood's top, if anyone wants to know, because of course he is.
Yeah, I was going to contest the sort of West Ham park in the bus thing. I don't think Pellegrini does that.
I think that might just be...
I think that's fear.
Like I said, both supporters I've spoken to have effectively cancelled each other out.
I think that sums up Everton and West Ham fans. Tom always comes on and says, if I was going to predict objectively, West Ham might win, but because I support them, we're going to lose 8-0.
He has actually revealed one of his predictions for this game. I think he expects Moise Kean to get his first Everton goal.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I would go with that. I think that's going to happen as well. I think that's...
Ken's in our predicted 11 in the preview that Ben wrote. So, to be clear, my prediction is that Calvert-Lewin comes on as a substitute.
Makes him even more of a hero. The maligned hero of Merseyside, because he's always criticised for not scoring. He's the only one that seems to be able to do it. Anyway, moving on from that fixture, we move on to the evening kickoff on TV, that game, which is Crystal Palace hosting Manchester City. And the main thing to pick out on this, and I'm not really going to help too much in terms of the actual prediction, but if Crystal Palace win their next 5 Premier League games, they're guaranteed to be at least second in the table. And that depends on how many points Liverpool win in that time.
I mean, if they beat City, they'll go ahead of them. They're only 2 points behind.
Yeah, exactly. But then, after that, so they play Man City at home. Man City is second. Then they then face Arsenal at the Emirates, where they won 3-2 last season. Arsenal are currently third. They then face fourth place Leicester at Selhurst Park, which was a 1-0 win last season. Then they play fifth place Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, which was a 3-1 defeat. And then they welcome currently leaders Liverpool to Selhurst Park. So they're playing all the teams directly above them, because I think this initially appeared on Reddit thread. Someone had spotted it. And then I sort of saw that and thought, surely this will mean if they win, they're going to... I wasn't confident in my maths, as I mentioned earlier as well. And then realised, yes, of course, if they beat all the teams directly above them, they will be at least second. And if Liverpool drop points at any point, then they could even be top of the table.
Wow. Yeah.
But obviously, they have to beat Man City at Selhurst Park, where, like we said at Old Trafford, not many goals are being scored at the moment, but they're being resolute. And Ollie Thomas, again, shout out to one of Squawker's writers, a Crystal Palace fan, has written a piece recently that sings about the unsung Crystal Palace heroes, because everyone knows that Wilfried Zaha is a key man in their team. But shout outs to the like of their goalie Guaita, and also Joel Ward and Martin Kelly, who weren't even in the team last season. Joel Ward's come in and replaced Aaron Wan-Bissaka seamlessly, and Martin Kelly playing at centre back has formed a solid partnership with Gary Cahill. So with Man City sort of desperate to just get those wins in, and they've still been pummeling teams but losing, Crystal Palace might prove once again a stern opposition for that Man City team, who could be frustrated quickly.
They can be frustrated, but I think you've got to remember they're coming off of a shocking loss to Wolves, right? So I think they're going to come out all guns blazing. City have traditionally responded pretty well, except with the exception of that period last time when they lost to Palace and lost to Leicester consecutive games. But I don't think that's going to happen this time, because they've had a break to cool off, to collect themselves. They're key. They're not as reliant on one key player, or rather, sorry, there's not one key player that's mysteriously absent, which Fernandinho obviously was for those two games, and that's got to destabilise everything on the counter-attack. Yeah, plus that Palace loss last game. I mean, Andros Townsend's never going to shoot like that again in his life. You know what I mean? That game like that, where everything, where he shot and So unless Townsend has another worldy shooting performance, I can't see them.
But that's the thing. I'll say Man City have already lost twice this season again.
Yeah.
And they've not been out like Wolves. It was a classic Wolves performance, wasn't it? And Adama Traore tripled his Premier League goal tally in one game.
What a man.
So it's always a rare occurrence. But you think, Crystal Palace have already played their card.
Yeah.
And also, the last time Man City lost in the Premier League, when it was to Norwich and everything was going to go bad, they beat Watford 8-0.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think they'll beat Palace 8-0, because I think Palace are very good defensively, whereas Watford aren't. But I do think they'll win. I think it'll be like 2-1. I think they might concede a goal. They might even concede first. But I think they've got enough about them to sort of just kick things up a notch if it goes bad again. Or, it's not likely they're going to want to follow a bad loss against Wolves with another bad loss. I think they'll pick up a win. 2-1.
And Crystal Palace, of course, looking to complete an early Manchester double with their win at Old Trafford already this season. And Old Trafford is where we're going to next, because that is the Sunday game. As we said, we've done all of the preamble on this, and everyone has all the stats they need. So all I need are those juicy predictions.
I think it's going to be 1-0 United. I think Klopp's going to go. Word. I think Klopp's going to go there.
Worth the wait, gang.
I think Klopp's going to go there, and he's going to be the same as last season. He's like, right, let's not lose the game, and let's just try and pick these off, because they're not very good, and they're not very good. United aren't very good, but United are actually a solid defensive side. They don't give up many shots. None of Liverpool's forwards play well against Man United, which is Liverpool's strength. Trent Alexander-Arnold is going to be a big, interesting factor. How do United deal with him? But if Rashford's playing left wing, I think Rashford's just going to chase him up and down the touchline, never give him any space. Liverpool are a better team than Man United. They're going to finish above Man United.
Remember, we've had all of this before.
I'm just saying.
So you don't need to review
I'm just saying, I think United will nick a goal. I think it will
be
Rashford.
You don't need to water down your fiery prediction.
Yeah. I think United will win. I think they'll win 1-0. They'll nick it.
Trousers.
Rashford will score, and it will be... Everyone will suddenly forget that he's played so poorly.
Well, I can't look past the fact that they're going to be without De Gea and Pogba. And I know those are two players who, like Mo said, De Gea's not in great form. And as I suggested, Pogba's not delivered against Liverpool previously. I would go with 2-1 Liverpool.
2-1.
A narrow win. I don't think it's going to be as one-sided as... Because obviously one thing we should say is that...
Here we go.
Liverpool are odds on at Old Trafford for this game with bookmakers for the first time in Premier League history, which reflects the discourse leading into this game. And it's all been... Man United could get a hiding.
Can they handle it? Can Liverpool handle being favourites? And remember, we'll be putting our accumulator of these predictions on the bet ball.
No, they can't.
Afterwards.
Well, my contention is no, they cannot.
But you can't.
This
bet ball accumulator is going to be difficult to put together now because...
Yeah. Well, I mean, no, well, that
we'll have
means
to do
you, get
democratic.
Cast, you get the casting
well,
vote.
Well, I was just going to say, despite...
Unless
all
you say a draw.
Liverpool haven't scored 2 yet at Old Trafford under Klopp. But I think that will change. And I just can't look past it. And the one thing about this Liverpool this season is that they have just been frustratingly and exhaustingly efficiently good. Mm. And the game against Burnley where they won 3-0, I was expecting that to be close and a 2-1 or a 1-1.
Yeah,
so I'm inverting my prediction and then predicting something like that. And I think Liverpool might just win 2-0 and it'd be really comfortable and easy. But how good will you feel if Man United do win and then you can do, and I told you so.
Well, you know I do love my I told you so.
Exactly. So I've done it for you, Mo.
I appreciate that, Jake. I do appreciate that.
And the final game we need to discuss, which is inspired by a listener's question by OC Lions blog. He's asked, are Arsenal overachieving again, similar to last year's unbeaten run early on in this season? Obviously relative to their visit to Bramall Lane on Monday night, Sunday completely dedicated to Liverpool, Man United, Premier League wise. And just a quick thought on that is, yes, definitely, it seems like Arsenal are overachieving because, as I mentioned on a previous podcast, and Will mentioned it when naming Aubameyang as your best striker so far, he is firing them up the table essentially single-handedly. The only thing is that Arsenal now are lucky to be third, but returning Lacazette, the introduction of Bellerin and Tierney, this should be now the Arsenal which can be judged properly.
Yeah, they've jammed their way so far, but now they could. Now Tierney is the big one for me because he's actually a left back, and he can defend as well as cross. And we saw. I mean, I know it's Europa League and it was against subpar opponents, but he was really good in the Europa League. I think got 2 assists. He was involved in the first 3 goals. He looks really, really good. Lacazette is great, and I think what also is good is that the return of Lacazette and everything, people like Joe Willock and that who have been performing well will now get to not be overexposed and burn out perhaps. So the form that Joe Willock is in, that Bukayo Saka is in, they can sort of almost bottle that and then be used in smaller spontaneous bursts and keep going rather than being playing every game and then eventually just wearing out, like what happened to Marcus Rashford actually.
Yeah, the fact that Bukayo Saka became one of the first names on the team sheet, 18 years old, obviously started in the game at Old Trafford and was again probably one of Arsenal's best performers. Matteo Guendouzi, 20-year-old midfielder, has been touted as Arsenal's best player, recently won the Player of the Month. With these, not necessarily, Bellerin is not old, but he's a senior player, and Tierney has been bought as a first-team left-back. Rob Holding is returning, who many Arsenal fans want as the captain, to be partnered alongside Callum Chambers. With Arsenal's players returning from injury, this is now the time to judge. However, the fact that I don't think they're all going to be back in time for Monday's game, based on what I've seen of Sheffield United, especially against Liverpool, what Bramall Lane can become, especially in one of these evening fixtures, Arsenal notoriously not dealing very well with a strong atmosphere, especially with the current squad. And with Chris Wilder's tactics as well, not playing someone like Mesut Ozil, who we can assume just won't play, means that Arsenal will really struggle to create chances, will rely on Aubameyang, and this might be one game too far after his Player of the Month award in the Premier League, not just Arsenal's Player of the Month, means that I can see a shock result, or it wouldn't be shocking to me personally, because of how pessimistic...
Because you're predicting it.
...the football, yes. Yeah. But a Sheffield United win I can see happening on Monday just by 1-0, but then that will actually refresh Arsenal, be like, yes, we've been bad, let's integrate these players, and now let's put in performances of which we should be truly judged. And if Arsenal don't perform well when Tierney, Bellerin, Holding, Lacazette are back, then that's when Unai Emery is going to have to be really, really concerned about his job. But that is all we have time for this week on the Squawker Talk of Football podcast. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this week. And thank you, BetBull, again, for sponsoring the episode. Look out for our accumulator that will be decided in post now that we have some contentious predictions. That will be on there this week. And thank you to my guests, Will.
No problem.
Thank you, Mo, for joining us.
Pleasure as always.
And Sam does not have a microphone to say cheers, mate, but he stepped in to do the sound editing this week. So thank you very much for that. And we'll be back to a full complement next Thursday.